Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Adam Ragusea, in for Anthony Brooks. A year ago this month, an explosion on the Deepwater Horizon oil rig in the Gulf of Mexico let slip a geyser of crude that gushed into the sea unchecked for 86 days. Today, that catastrophe is echoed as radioactive isotopes flood the waters around the stricken nuclear plant in Japan. It's been a tough year for the world's oceans.
Marine biologist Carl Safina, though, is an optimist. Despite all that is happening to the ocean, he says the future is by no means doomed. In his new PBS series, Saving the Ocean, Safina turns his attention on promising conservation efforts around the world.
In my travels, I see disturbing things. Overfishing, pollution in remote places, people who don't have much to eat because their reefs are in trouble. But I also see inspiring people working to solve these problems. And that's what this series is about. In every episode, we'll visit people who have solutions.
And the solutions featured in Saving the Ocean range from an Islamic conservation movement in a Zanzibar fishing village to a return to some more traditional and lower-impact fishing methods right here in New England. Saving the Ocean premieres here in Boston on Channel 2 this weekend, and Carl Safina joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Thanks for being here. Your first episode takes us to the island of Pemba in the Zanzibar archipelago on the East African coast, a very poor fishing community that has embraced conservation in part for theological reasons. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I think many of our great wisdom traditions have almost anything you would want to find in them, and certain things have been emphasized at the expense of others. But what we're seeing in some religious communities is that the parts that have to do with stewardship are being rediscovered. So there in Pemba, these people have had trouble with their reefs. They're kind of running out of land, and religion is extremely important to them. It kind of anchors the whole community. And what they're seeing is that there are things in the Quran that say, for instance, if you cut a tree, you must plant a tree. And based on that, they are replanting the mangroves that they cut down for housing and firewood.
And that Islamic conservation ethic was brought to Pemba by a British imam named Fazlan Khalid. And here you are talking to him. We have a clip.
You are Allah's Khalifa. You're God's steward. So your job is to protect. God says in Quran that he has sent everything for you for your benefit. But he also says, La yuhibbu al-musrifin. Allah does not love the wasters. He's very, very strong.
He doesn't love the wasters.
Yes. Allah does not love wasters or the destroyers.
Yeah. It's really extraordinary in your series to see these people who are desperately poor, people who you would think would only be concerned about their own day-to-day subsistence, giving up things like spear guns because they're too effective at bringing down the big fish. So is this enlightened self-interest that you're seeing here, or is it purely theological?
It's entirely enlightened self-interest. They see that they're running out, and they are trying to understand why, what they've been doing wrong. And because they apply a religious filter to a lot of their lives, they see that in their religious text, it helps to instruct them on what they're seeing. So it gives them sort of a theological cover, in a sense, to do the right thing based on the problems that they're perceiving.
The next episode in your series is about a conservation zone in another quite poor fishing community, this one off the coast of Belize. And it's a place where sharks are harvested for their fins, for shark fin soup, which is popular in China. And it's a pretty horrific process in which the sharks are caught and their fins are hacked off, and then the rest of the shark is thrown back in the sea to die. Let's listen to a scene in which your guide takes you to see a man who sells shark fins.
Do you have some shark fins for us?
That's right.
It took a dozen large sharks to fill this one bag.
How much would you sell this for?
About $50 to $40. $40 to $50 a pound.
$40 to $50 a pound?
That's right.
Prices like this are driving a global trade of staggering proportions.
The estimates of how many sharks are taken for the fin trade is now somewhere between 22
to 75 million sharks annually are taken for the fin trade. Do you think there's more sharks now or fewer sharks?
Right now, I feel like sharks are more fewer right now.
There's more fewer?
Yeah.
So you think there's too much fishing on the sharks?
Well, people use their boats for fishing for a living, no?
Yeah.
People have to go to fishing for a living, no, is what the man says. And,
yes, that's
and,
what he says, yes.
You know, at those kinds of prices, you can't blame him. How have these people been convinced to cut back on the shark hunt?
Well, I would say, in a sense, they have not been convinced to cut back on the shark hunt. What's happened there is that the government has put some places off limits to fishing to allow the fish to recover. We were focusing on sharks because if the sharks can live in an area, everything else can live in an area. And we were seeing that in this area where the fish are allowed to recover, the sharks are able to exist and persist. We went out with fishermen about 20 miles away from there. We set a net that was 3/4 of a kilometer long overnight, and they caught nothing, not one fish.
Yeah, that was incredible. You were so surprised, you could tell.
I was shocked.
You had gone there to see what is essentially, you know, you said it's a vacuum cleaner for fish, and the vacuum cleaner hadn't caught anything.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
Right. It was staggering. Yeah, I was shocked by that.
You point out that that shark fin consumption has gone down in Hong Kong in part because of some public awareness campaigns. I think we actually have a clip of that awareness campaign right here.
I pledge. I pledge not to eat.
Not to eat.
Not to eat shark fin soup.
To eat.
So that's had whatever its effect it's had, but still the shark fin consumption is exploding on mainland China. You and I could go down to downtown Boston right now and step into Chinatown and find a dozen places that serve it. What's up with that? Is that a harvesting practice that can in any way be justified, or does that need to be banned?
Well, I think that one does need to be banned at this point because the sharks simply can't withstand it. The shark populations off this coast have gone down very noticeably over the course of my lifetime. I used to do a lot of recreational fishing and catch and release for sharks. They were once very common, and they're very uncommon now, big sharks, because of this. It is banned in some places. And in some places where it is banned, the enforcement is good. In other places, the enforcement is not good. In other places, there is no ban, and the problem really, is continuing.
We're talking with marine biologist Carl Safina, whose new series on PBS, Saving the Ocean, premieres this weekend here in Boston. One of the episodes that I understand you're in the process of shooting actually looks at the cod fisheries here in New England, which have rebounded a bit. Tell us about that.
Well, we're planning that. We're not in the process yet. The federal law has now prohibited overfishing as of this year. Finally, none of the fishery management councils can allow fishing at a rate that is faster than the rate the fish can reproduce. Yeah. And so these restrictions, which have been very difficult and very hard fought, but are in the best long-term interest of everybody, are starting to bear fruit. Many of the declines have been slowed. Some of them have been arrested, and a few of the declines have been turned into recoveries for haddock, for cod, for even swordfish. And so what we wanted to show is how certain kinds of fishing that is scaled down can be very profitable for people who are not using big nets that they drag across the bottom where they catch too much, they throw too much away, they damage the bottom. These scaled down fishing methods don't do any of that, and they're very profitable, and the fishermen can get a premium for those fish because they come up in better shape. They're not as old when they're brought to the dock. They're just caught that day mostly.
Carl Safina, I wonder, I mean, inspiring as these stories may be, I have to imagine that they represent exceptions to the rule, right? I mean, I assume, and tell me if I'm wrong, that most fish stocks in the world are sinking lower and lower and lower. And maybe by focusing on these few and far between success stories, do you risk presenting a rosy picture to people?
I don't think that we're trying to present them as the success stories so much as they are solutions to the problems. We're not saying that there aren't problems. We're not saying the problems aren't big. We're not saying that the solutions are what predominate. We're saying that here is a vision for how we could all do it much better. If everybody did these things that these people are doing, these problems could be fixed.
As we mentioned at the top, we're coming up on the first anniversary of the Deepwater Horizon oil spill in the Gulf. You have a new book coming out about that disaster called Sea in Flames. What is the lasting impact of that spill been that we can see up to this point?
Oh, a few things. There have been some lasting negative effects, of course. There has been greatly increased scrutiny on safety and safety issues on the rigs. It's still very much, I would say, a moving picture because the safety is not completely secure. The problems have not completely gone away. Many of the problems that people most feared did not fully come to fruition in the way that people feared. They weren't as bad as people feared, but there's still very much a lack of preparedness if another well blows out. There's better safety to prevent wells from blowing out, but it's far from perfect, and the lack of preparedness is still there. There are also bigger problems that are longer lasting. The problems with the Mississippi Delta washing away those vast wetlands,
yeah,
we've already lost about a third of them over the last 30 years or so, has really nothing directly to do with that blowout. It has something to do with the whole oil industry that's cut about 10,000 miles of canals through the Delta. The banks of those canals constantly crumble and erode. It has a lot to do with the flood control upstream that shoots the river straight out a channel, and all of the sand and mud and silt that builds the Delta aren't coming into the Delta. So the Delta is washing away. That's a big problem. It has nothing directly to do with the blowout, and that problem remains.
It's a bigger story, and we look forward to hearing you tell it. Carl Safina's Saving the Ocean premieres this Sunday at noon on Channel 2 here in Boston, and the following Wednesday at 8 p.m. on New Hampshire Public Television. More info is at radioboston.org. Carl Safina, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks an awful lot for having me in.
Well, we have to take one more break, but when we come back, if I might say, there's another great thing about the oceans. It's a wonderful place to spend the summer, or if you're a kid, maybe summer camp, especially out on the Cape, except one Cape camp has been delivering some pretty bad news, and that has many parents wondering about camp safety all across Massachusetts. We'll take a look next in our talker. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Adam Ragusea, in for Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.